over the years, I've heard, and I'm sure many of you have as well, different attempts to explain aspects of the seven churches. And there's a number of different approaches to understanding what they are. You know, the seven churches themselves don't exist any longer. Those congregations pretty much disappeared from history. In fact, all of the cities to which those seven churches belonged are today nothing but archaeological ruins. Now, other cities have been, over time, have been built in most cases in approximately the same space or the same place that the biblical city existed in. But they have enough commonality in history to make it interesting to try to see them from a holistic point of view before worrying too much about their individual characteristics. What you find, if you dig deep, you got to dig pretty deep, but if you dig pretty deep, you find that in the letters to the seven churches, there are certain things that are said that really have to do with something that you or I wouldn't know about the city that that church was in, not the church itself, but the city in which the church was situated. And in a way that personalizes the seven messages. But I want to set the stage for all that and then quickly run through what the content is. Not in great detail. That would just really take us too long, but at least cover some of the high points and try to get a sense of who these folks were. So they existed, and the cities that are where they used to be, I'll give you their current Turkish names, if you like. Ephesus is now near a city that's named Selçuk. Smyrna is essentially in a city, modern city called Izmir, which is a pretty important city in Turkey. Pergamum is, there's a city there roughly where Pergamum was called Bergama. So they didn't really change that one a whole lot. Thyatira, there's a Turkish town there called Akhisar. Sardis, the ruins are called Sark. They're near a little town called Sahlili. Philadelphia is essentially located in a modern city called Al-Shahir, and Laodicea is located, the ruins are there, and you can go look at them, near the Turkish city of Denizli. So there are people living there, and primarily the people who live there today are Turkish Muslims, primarily. They're not Christians. There's these congregations to whom the letters were composed, for whom the letters were composed, are people who passed out of history in the past. And I wanted to kind of set up for us the commonality, the reason they are in the place in history they're in, and ask some questions that you and I might not have thought about very much, if ever, about why these seven churches. There were lots of churches in the world by then. By the late first century, some 60 years or so after Jesus' death, roughly 60 years after Jesus' death, there were lots and lots of churches. And we know there were a lot of churches because Paul mentions quite a few of them. Paul was a planter of many of the churches, almost none of these. He was sort of involved in getting Ephesus up and going. But the other six, we don't know specifically that Paul visited them, although in Colossians 4:16, I think it is, he asks the elders at Colossae to take the letter to their friends in Laodicea. And Laodicea, that's the only place in the Bible Laodicea is mentioned. So they were real places. They're not now, but they're in places where it made sense to build a city. In every case, They're by rivers. And in the old days, long, long time ago, when Judy and I were small children, there was no such thing as public waterworks. For example, people went with a bucket to the river and they got water. And the really rich people paid people to go to the river and get water. And in some cases, people dug wells because the water table was near the surface where they lived and that sort of thing. So all of these cities were actually built in favorable locations on water courses. That particular part of the world that we call Asia Minor is mountainous nearly all the way across this entire region that we're talking about. I'm going to use the term Anatolia a fairly good bit. Anatolia is the old name for what is most of modern Turkey, the part that sticks out over the Mediterranean and is underneath the Black Sea, that which is most of Turkey. In those days was called Anatolia in a very general kind of way. The Anatolians were a group of tribes of people that weren't really closely related to anybody else. Now, they were descendants of Japheth, the eldest son of Noah, but they really had language groups entirely unto themselves. In fact, one of the languages in Anatolia, the oldest language known to archaeologists, not just biblically speaking, but to archaeologists, is the Hittites. And there's an ongoing debate whether the Hittites that Abraham knew in Canaan were the same as the Hittite kingdom in Anatolia, given that particularly that the Hittite kingdom in Anatolia had moved south over time and even had, for a period of time, rulership over Egypt. They had their own dynasty, basically, in Egypt. So we're busy folks in Anatolia. But most of the rest of the time, Anatolians kind of didn't mess with other people very much except each other. But at the time we're looking at, things had been through a lot of ferment. The first Babylonian Empire had emerged. The what's called Neo-Assyrian, the one that the Sennacherib came and carried off the 10 tribes and all that, they had emerged, pretty much run their course. They were followed by what's called the Neo-Babylonian Empire, which is Nebuchadnezzar and those guys. And they were all kin to each other. Nebuchadnezzar's third in line after him for the throne was actually an Assyrian, for example. And in fact, Assyria had off and on used Babylon as its imperial seat, just depending on the mood of the king. Then the dynamics began to come into place for the Persian period, which is, you know, what pretty well known to us due to the books of Esther, Nehemiah, and Ezra. The Persian kings, really, as far as the Jewish people were concerned, were really pretty benevolent. Haman didn't like them very much, but he didn't get away with anything. He tried, but he didn't. And they began a westward push into Anatolia. Now, that began a little bit before the Persians, when there was a group called the Medians, or later called the Medes, pushed into Anatolia, and they were pushing westward. And that caused things to be unsettled for the folks out on the western end of Anatolia, which is what we're interested in. And the Medes actually were senior to the Persians in a joint venture to have an empire. And it was called the Medo-Persian Empire. But in about the third king in, the Persians took over completely and pushed the Medians essentially out of history. In the meantime, the mischief that had begun in central Anatolia had spilled over into the west. Now, at the same time, Greeks from the Greek mainland, Achaia, were coming across the Aegean Sea into what is now Western Turkey, and they were setting up colonies on the coast. Three of those colonies, there were quite a few, but three of those were called Ephesus, Smyrna, and Thyatira. Those are three of the seven cities in the letters to the seven churches. So those were Greek cities, but the Greeks weren't kin per se to the people, the central people, and those guys were called Lydians. And so there was conflict, but there was also a tremendous amount of trade, because now the Greeks on the ports at the western end, and they were the nearest ports to Greece, who controlled the trade routes into Europe for anybody coming out of Asia. That's a complex bunch of stuff. Well, Alexander the Great came along, and for about after he kind of beat the Greeks into submission, he wasn't a Greek. He was actually a Macedonian. But after he beat the Greeks into submission, he crossed, he went over across there, got into Asia Minor, what we call Asia Minor, and the three Greek port cities, and pretty quickly had control of all those. And then he began to move east, and he pretty much ran the Persians out. All the Persians ran home, and Alexander chased them, and then he beat them really bad and chased them all the way to India at the Indus River. He finally had a big battle where he beat the last Persian king, and then he drank himself to death. Quite a fellow. But he left his empire to four of his generals, one of whom was named Lysimachus. And Lysimachus ended up with our area of interest, the western part of the Anatolian Peninsula and the original homeland of Macedon and Thracia and so forth. Well, he and the fellow next to him, one of Alexander's other buddies, a fellow by the name of Seleucus, got into it. And there was a good bit of back and forth and back and forth. And in time, the Seleucids ran Lysimachus never really had a comfortable name, but ran Lysimachus's people out of six of the seven cities. And eventually then, that began to collapse, and these fellows began to turn themselves into the Romans. They just said, you know, let's be Romans. It was mostly fairly peaceful, the coming of the Romans. And the Romans are the folks we find in this part of the world when we get there. The Romans consolidated a good bit of that territory, put the Lydian non-Greeks and the Aeolian and Ionian Greeks together into an area called Asia, which was really just the western end of Asia Minor, but it was a Roman province of Asia. Past them was another Roman province of Lydia. Now, many of the provinces that you read about, Paul's missionary work in particular, are in that part of the world. The province names are scattered all through there. Paphlagonia, Cilicia, places like that. They're all in fairly near proximity to the area of interest to us. But the term Asia was used just for that western end where these seven cities are. So that sets us up. So the Romans were in charge. It was really a fairly amicable relationship between the Romans and these folks most of the time. Now, there was a little bit of trouble in the east, and from time to time, these guys lined up on the wrong side and they're getting out of sorts with Rome and all of that kind of stuff. But eventually, the Roman Empire brought a pretty good measure of peace to that part of the world. And in the time that we get to, when we're looking at these churches, things were pretty well settled. These places, for the most part, prospered from Roman rule. We don't have a system like they had, both the Greeks and the Romans, whereby becoming a city was a matter of petitioning the government to call you a city. And when the government called you a city, it changed the way you paid taxes. It changed whether or not you got, for example, government funding for big public projects, especially temples, things of that sort. And these guys were all cities in that time. One of them was actually, two of them were actually pretty new. Sardis and Laodicea weren't very old. They didn't go through much of that history. They were actually started during the Greek period. So they were never anything but Greco-Roman cities. And I use the term Greco-Roman to mean the ones that the Romans got away from the Greeks when the Seleucid Empire fell apart. A lot of other stuff relates to that, but we would just have to do that, obviously, at another time, lest we get too terribly bogged down in it. So John knew of these places, obviously, because the island on which John lived, a small island off the coast named Patmos, really wasn't very far from landfall, and it was only slightly north and west, mostly west and a little bit north of Ephesus, which is the first one, first of the seven churches that are listed. So we don't know exactly what John was doing. I'm sure there are some traditions in the Catholic Church about all that, but I don't know them. I don't have time enough to read everything I need to read, much less getting into everything all the Catholics ever wrote. So, there's a lot I won't know. So I'm okay with that. But John had the most peculiar time. It was on the Lord's Day. Now, if I say was the Lord's Day on Sunday, most all of us will raise our hands, right? Because we've heard all of our lives that the term the Lord's Day referring to Sunday. But actually, it was not determined that Sunday would be called the Lord's Day until a couple of hundred years later. So it's not clear that John meant Sunday. In fact, there's a good chance that John was actually speaking of Saturday. And it doesn't actually matter very much, except that he said, on the Lord's Day, I was in the Spirit. John was in the Spirit. Nobody told John to be in the Spirit. He just was. You know, and then we kind of get into, we could have some real fisticuffs over what does it mean to be in the Spirit. Judy and I come out of a Baptist tradition, for example. And in the Baptist church, being in the Spirit meant you were calm and peaceful and maybe not talking to other people. That would be being in the Spirit. We didn't stay there, and we got into a little bit rowdier bunches of people over time. And being in the Spirit came to mean something else to us. And there's biblical evidence for what I call being in the Spirit, but not everybody believes it because they don't like certain aspects of it. There are people who are bound and determined that anybody who does speak in tongues, for example, probably can't go to heaven because who could understand them after all when they get there, that sort of thing. So we have that just disagreement about what John meant about that. So those two pieces are interesting to think about. But what really matters is John heard a voice and it was behind him. Now, almost never in scripture, in any other case, do we hear about somebody hearing a voice and thinking of it directionally. It's a very unusual thing for John to say, I heard a voice behind me. Now, I interpret that for those of, and again, we could disagree, it doesn't really matter. I interpreted that being 180 degrees from straight ahead. That's behind me. Anything else isn't quite behind me, whatever. So back there somewhere, John heard a voice, and it was a particularly striking voice, and John turned to see who was speaking. And he saw someone that he did not recognize, and he described the person that he saw in totally anthropomorphic terms, but really weird anthropomorphic terms. Like he had a face, he had hands, he had feet, he had eyes, he spoke, and so forth and so on. But other than that, nothing was much normal about the fellow. And it says that John, pretty much upon seeing him, was overwhelmed and essentially swooned. So John's record of what he saw was based on his memory of what he saw, but it wasn't something that he processed for a long period of time. He didn't stand, look, draw a sketch or anything like that. He saw, and quickly it was overwhelming to him, and he swooned, and the person identified himself at that point. Now, John knew Jesus. John was with Jesus on the Mount of Transfiguration. He was one of the three that was with Jesus at Transfiguration. So this wasn't a transfigured Jesus that he was seeing, because they already knew that one. This was a different Jesus. The Jesus on the Mount of Transfiguration, for those of you who are trying to figure it out, was not the one that John saw there on the island of Patmos, probably in his prison cell. The Romans would sometimes, if you had some money, they would let you rent a place to live if you would pay for the cost of the soldiers that would be your guards, that type of thing. John probably didn't have a lot of money, so he's probably really in jail. So in prison, in his prison cell, he saw this apparition to him what initially appeared to be an apparition. And the apparition identified himself, and there were several comments that John made about his appearance. I'll point some of those out. John saw, no, he told John he was a faithful witness. That's not where I want to be. His head, John noticed his head and hair, his eyes, his feet, his voice, his right hand, his mouth, and his face. Only his right hand. John saw him at least two occasions with something in his hand, but it was his right hand every time. That just, you know, for those people that are left-handed, that doesn't mean there's not a place for you in the kingdom of God. It just means that there's something in particular about the right hand. It is so particular that in many cultures, it's practically a religious matter, the right hand, because you could only eat with your right hand. So, you know, if you lost your right hand, that was not a very good thing. And let's don't get into all that that indicates. But the right hand also is the place where he sat when he went to be with his father. It says he was seated at his father's right hand. The right hand aspect of the thing was very important. And so Jesus pointed it out. Now, those things, his eyes, his feet, his right hand, and his mouth are all mentioned in at least one of the seven letters. So what John saw, to some degree, what John saw was Jesus letting John see him as he is with respect to those attributes of Jesus that would be important in understanding the letters to come. There might be other things that Jesus could have revealed. How can I possibly say a thing like that? Well, when Jesus, the day that Jesus was known to be resurrected, he walked some distance, probably about 3 miles, walking along, probably at a slow pace with at least two other fellas, talking to them, and they knew him, except they didn't. So even in their presence, he wasn't fully revealed to them. So John was seeing what I call the realized Jesus, in and to the extent and in the attributes that Jesus chose for John to see him, knowing that in the letters to come, these things would matter. These would be things that John would actually talk about. Now, we can't necessarily imagine anything about this, but had Jesus been intending to address some other issues with some of the churches, he might have looked differently. John might have seen differently than he saw. Is that okay with you? Jesus wasn't disguising himself. He was simply presenting himself to John as he chose to present himself to John, because John was going to present him to the seven churches in that manner. And in some of the cases, those churches were going to be impacted, something in particular having to do with Jesus in the letter that is addressed to them. Another thing about these letters is that John wrote down all seven of them as part of a single document. So however John got the document off the island of Patmos into the hands of somebody who could deliver them to the elders in these different churches, they probably all got a copy of all seven letters. They probably got a copy of the entire book of Revelation, in fact. There's no evidence that John mailed the letters. I have it on good authority that the post office hadn't even been built on Patmos yet. It wasn't really even there yet. So John couldn't mail them. In fact, it's a question whether they were even in the envelopes in those days. And certainly stamps were hard to come by. I mean, John couldn't have, it doesn't make sense that a man in prison could have sent them out separately all over the place. And in fact, Jesus' instruction to him was to write them all down. And so John recorded them all. Before Jesus spoke to him about changing location for the rest of the book. So there's something very, very particular that the Lord wanted to reveal by way of John to the Christians, essentially nearby, They weren't very, very far away. It's not easy to tell. Patmos is such a small island. It's not really easy to tell how much water one would have to cross to get over to the coast. But from the standpoint of riding in a boat, it really wasn't very far. One time in 2006, Judy and I slept between Athens and a port in Turkey called Kushadasi, which is pretty near to Ephesus. And really, they went real slow that night because it really just isn't far across there. Nonetheless, John didn't have access probably to any kind of transportation himself. And he would know how to get these, in a sense, smuggled off the island into the hands of somebody. And he just didn't write it down seven times, I don't think. It was all written once. So the guys in Ephesus got to see the letter to the guys in Smyrna and the guys in Thyatira and so forth. And they actually, not only did they understand the references for Ephesus, they understood the references for the other cities as well. Now, these cities were all actually pretty well connected to each other. They were all cities that, at least part of the time, were pretty significant trading locations. In fact, large cities in those days. While you had to appeal to the government to be called a city, usually you could appeal to the government based on the fact that there was a lot of trade going on and a lot of tax revenue headed for the government. Therefore, you deserve to be called a city. That was kind of the way it all worked, is quid pro quo, as they say. So these guys had fairly direct routes between the cities, even though it was kind of mountainous area. There's actually a system that's almost all pretty low valley between Laodicea and Ephesus, for example, between Smyrna and Sardis. They're on the same river. You could just go down the Hermus River and go from Sardis down to Smyrna on the coast. No big deal. Up the coast, of course, was fairly easy walk. But in fact, one of the interesting things that you discover in studying these places is that you could leave Ephesus one day, and I don't know how many days it would take you, proceed to the next city on the list, which is Smyrna, by going north, proceed north and get to Pergamum, go east to get to Thyatira, go slightly southwest and get to Sardis, slightly southeast and get to Philadelphia, and almost due south and be at Laodicea, only 60 miles from where you left Ephesus, never crossing your own line of travel. They're laid out specifically on what you could call a route. But amongst them, the ones inland, Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia, and Laodicea, generally speaking, there were fairly easy routes of trade with the three coastal cities. Sardis, which is one of the Lydian cities in the interior, city number 12345 on the list, actually, during the time of the Persians built a special royal highway from their capital city of Susa down in Persia all the way to Sardis, specifically to carry royal trade. And Sardis was very directly connected to Smyrna on the coast, trade to Europe back and forth and so forth. So these guys, the people knew each other, they had relatives and so forth. Another thing about these cities is that all of them had fairly significant Jewish populations. At one time, in fact, one of the Seleucid kings, one of the Antiochus guys, I think Antiochus III, but I'm not sure about that, sent 20,000 Jews from places in Persia to Sardis because that's where he operated, was it Sardis or Philadelphia, because of his operations in that part of the country. But all of them had significant Jewish congregations, and I'll get to that and why that matters in just a moment. So when John saw these things and addressed these things, it was like everybody lived on the same block, kind of. You know, it was kind of like a one long letter to the neighborhood, but everybody, part of it was written for Bob, and part of it was for Bill, and part of it was Susie, and that sort of thing. Okay, so we probably ought to get that out there in the open. They were not the only churches in the world. Now, another approach that people take is say, well, they represented seven particular kinds of problems. That's actually hard to pull out. You can sort of make it work if you want to, but that's because you want it to. not because it's necessarily that way. But the Lord did, I think, intend to show things that had to do with the representation of himself in the first chapter amongst the seven. For example, in speaking to, I think, Smyrna, he speaks of a crown. And there was an area on the eastern side of the city where it was a pretty good sized hill. And they had built a number over time, a number of public buildings around that hill. And it was that area was called the Crown of Smyrna. So when he talked about a crown to the Smyrna Christians, there was a resonance. This is something that actually meant something to them. The Lydians, the four interior cities, particularly Sardis, but also I think Philadelphia might have been involved as well, got us started with debased money. They, up the river from there was a river up from the city. I can't think of the name of it, Patolis or something like that, that it had a particular mineral in it that is known hardly anywhere else in the world, called electrum, E-L-E-C-T-R-U-M. In fact, we get the word electron from it and electricity originally. Not sure why it's called electrum, but that's what it was. And what it is actually an alloy of gold and silver. And it comes in a variety of mixes, anywhere from 20% gold up to 80% gold and obverse for silver, but with small amounts of other metals, sometimes copper and other metals that are fairly easily amalgamated into these alloys. And what the Lydian kings discovered was that people couldn't tell how much gold there was in there, and they couldn't tell how much silver was in there. So they could take some metal that was mostly silver, turn it into coins, and give it a value based on that weight of gold. And the government kept the difference. Isn't that cute? Now, you know, if you haven't studied it, you don't even want to know, but it's kind of fun to figure out how much American coinage has been debased in a little over 200 years we've been around. But we have nowhere near the metal, precious metals in our coins that we had originally. In fact, we don't have any silver anymore, and there haven't been there's some specialty coins, but not for ordinary circulation. And we hadn't had gold in there for, I don't even know, 100 years nearly. So we're doing the value of coins based on what we stamp on them, not the metal content in them. But in the ancient world, and really up until fairly modern times, a coin was worth whatever the metal in it was worth. If gold was worth $50 an ounce and you had an ounce, a coin that weighed an ounce, it was worth $50. That simple. The coin, making it into a coin, added no value to it. But because electrum debased gold, in essence, by the presence of silver, the king could say, we'll an ounce size coin is worth $50 because that's how much gold is worth. You see how that would work? And it might only really be worth $12. In fact, over time, they added some other stuff to it, and they got down around the gold down around 40 to 50%, nowhere near the 60 that it commonly was, or even on occasion 80. The government makes a lot of money on those transactions. There's a lot of stuff that has to happen, but the government makes the profits. So these guys gave us that. Well, it makes sense in a trading center. If you're trading coins for commodities and you're basically telling people that the coin has a commodity value when it doesn't. You see how that would work? And then you charge them taxes on top of that. So these cities were getting rich. And then the port cities, Ephesus and Smyrna and Pergamum, they just made money on taxes. They didn't even have to do that kind of stuff. They made money straight up on taxes. But when the traders left the coast, they went inland and they ended up in one of those three or four Lydian cities that ended up being amongst the seven. So lots of commonality, lots of back and forth, relatives in the different cities. And as I said earlier, by this time, the Jews were everywhere. Jerusalem was no longer a fun place to be if you were Jewish. In 70, the Romans had knocked down the temple the first time. Then they finished the job in 135. But this is about 20 years before John. The Romans had knocked down the temple. Now, some of the folks got it and left. Even before that, because of the trouble between the Jews and the Christians, Jewish Christians left Jerusalem. And the book of Acts even speaks of that. And Paul, once he got let loose, got the authority accumulated, the authority that he needed to go chase Christians, was going to Ephesus with what we would call letters of mark. So that gave him permission within the Jewish community to take Jewish people as prisoners. And the local authorities were unlikely to do anything about it. They would be taken prisoners and hauled back to Jerusalem. The Christians were scattering around the earth as well. That was Paul's job. After he became saved, and he had to go into training for about 20 years, but in a while, Paul's job was to go around to those same places where the Jews had scattered to that didn't really have a Christian presence, go to the synagogues, speak to the Jews, and tell them, here's another variation on our faith, the faith of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And some would receive the message and become members of the Christian sect, as they called it in that time. And eventually, you can even read about it. For example, in I believe it's in Corinth, is a pretty good description. Eventually, Paul did all that he could do, and all of them that were going to come out of the synagogue ended up in the church. And then that turned to trouble sooner or later, because usually the Jews still outnumbered the Christians. But in these places, that had only begun in the time frame in which Paul was traveling around. In fact, he was in and out of Ephesus, for example. The others we're not sure about, but Colossae was pretty close, like maybe 30 miles from Philadelphia. So Paul was counting on the interrelationships. Maybe from people from Philadelphia came to see him in Colossae. So we're setting up something that makes sense that these seven would be addressed together rather than just some sort of random assortment, right? But then the revelation of himself as the speaker and the giver of this information included some clues about his appearance that he then turns around and uses. But he also uses, as I mentioned earlier, things about the cities themselves. For example, in the letter to the church in Laodicea, if you remember, the Laodiceans were told, you know, you're neither cold nor hot. You're just lukewarm. And if you're just going to keep being lukewarm, I'm just going to spit you out. Now, that doesn't sound like it's a very good thing to happen to you. It sort of feels like being spit out of the mouth of Jesus because you're lukewarm probably is not good news, right? And again, that also emphasizes his mouth. Well, it turns out that during times of drought, Laodicea's water supply was fairly limited. And they actually had an aqueduct built up into a mountain, I think northeast of them, that would draw water down to the city, water, you know, gravity-fed aqueduct into the city out of an area that had hot springs in it. So hot water was coming down the tube, and by the time it got to town, it was generally considered to be lukewarm. You see how the Lord, in delivering an aspect of message, made it very relevant to the Laodiceans. They knew what he meant when he said lukewarm, because it actually was a feature of their water supply system. I'm guessing, but I bet you'll support me on this, there probably was not an ice dispenser they could put that warm water into. That seem okay with you? So when they got lukewarm water, they just had lukewarm water. There was no ice to put in it to cool it for them. That's what they got. And if you were thirsty that day, you know, and you maybe missed getting water yesterday, that may be what you got was lukewarm water, and that's what you got. It's a thing that was known. It was known about them all through the region. See, so what we're getting at here. So the Lord is sending messages about really important things. And he's doing it through the methodology of addressing these specific groups of people who knew each other, who were originally sort of Greek, sort of Anatolian, had been in various alliances with each other, sometimes having a little bit of fisticuffs with each other over the long haul, had been under the domination of Persians. The Syrians had messed with them a little bit, but the Persians a whole bunch. Alexander had sort of freed them up in 334, I believe was the year he supposedly went through there. Then Seleucus, one of his, Lysimachus, one of his successors, ruled the place for a while, for, I don't know, three or four generations. And then Seleucus pushed the Lysimachus family out and took over, and they ran the place for a good little while. And then they kind of fell apart and the Romans got it. At one point in time, in fact, a fellow by the name of Mark Antony got his girlfriend, Miss Cleopatra of the Ptolemy, a branch of the Greek part of the world, and they ran up to Ephesus and raised a navy near the port of Ephesus to fight with one of his, I think, Octavius in the battle of, I don't remember the name of the battle, but one of the big naval battles that determined the fact that Mark just wasn't going to win. And so he and Liz went home and got friendly with snakes or whatever it is they did. That ended the Ptolemy, which is one of the other branches of what Alexander left in the earth. In fact, much of Daniel, I think it's in about the 10th or 11th chapter, a good bit of the material in Daniel really talks about the struggles between the Seleucid and Ptolemy Greeks, predicting them in the time that the Persians were in power. Daniel was writing about these, not by name, but writing about these people. Remember something there about the king of the north and the king of the south and the daughter from the king of the, goes to the north, and all that stuff. That's really referring to the Greek struggles among these successors to Alexander. The Romans, again, were mostly welcomed, and they were the guys in charge when John was imprisoned in the area. So setting that aspect in place again. So let me get into some kind of specifics, but I really want to get us to a brief discussion of the bequeathals to the overcomers or the victors. The action, I'm not sure I didn't go back and look at King James. I should have, but I didn't. And I don't have a Bible here right now. Besides, I don't want to use your time up in that manner. But some translations and speaking to the seven churches at the end of each of the letters, very near the end, there's an address to people called overcomers. An overcomer is a word, we kind of get it. There's an obstacle and we get past it. When I was in high school, I did a little bit in college, but only intramural. They talked me into, I don't know how anybody ever convinced me to do this. They would go out and set these wooden structures out upon the track and say, go run over that, boy. And I did it time after time after time. Not well, but I did that a lot. Now, it's only fair to say I only weighed 130 pounds in those days. So I was pretty light and moderately fast. There were hurdles. And has nothing to do with what I'm getting at here. But the point of dealing with the seven particulars brings out a number of things. And I overcame most of the hurdles. Now, there was an occasion. In those days, we used cinder as the surface for the track, crushed cinder. When you fall on that, it hurts and you bleed. Stuff they're doing now is not so bad for you, but I bled a lot. Anyway, one track meet, I remember they were ready to start, but I took most hurdlers, we would take a practice run, try to get our steps right And you can't do that very far at a time because your muscle memory just loses it. So you're going to get your steps right, because if you don't get over your steps right, you don't really clear the first hurdle very well. And if you don't clear the first hurdle, the rest of them are in danger, except that you're actually the one in danger. So I was trying to get my steps on the first hurdle, had just fallen over it and landed on my hands, and I was bleeding copiously, and the whistle blew. So I had to run back to the starting blocks and get in place for the race. I remember that vividly. Lots of blood. And it was red cinder. I mean, I don't know whether it was red before or not, but it was that day. I was not an overcomer in that event. In fact, I think I came in third that particular heat, and probably just from loss of blood. I'm not real sure. But it messed me up in any event. And so I was not victorious. The word that is used for overcomer in the seven letters is actually victor. Those who are victorious. The Nikao, from which we get the name Nike for tennis shoes. And it just means victory. There's even a statue somewhere to Nike, sort of a goddess of liberty, if I'm not mistaken. So Nike is actually the Greek word for victory, who was something that was essentially deified by the Greeks. Okay. By the way, when Smyrna was kind of turning themselves over to the Romans, they were a little bit inconsistent for a while, and they got in a little bit of trouble with the Romans, but the Romans made a deal. And what the Smyrnans decided to do was they would start, they sort of initiated emperor worship amongst Romans. They were the first place on any scale to do emperor worship. And one of the other cities, I think it was Pergamum on the coast, actually deified a goddess named Roma, who was the mother goddess of the city of Rome, and therefore the Roman Empire. Now, that was a Greco-Roman kind of thing to do, because they had a lot of deities. Ephesus had a great temple to a goddess named Artemis. It's not outside the city. Judy and I went to the city ruins. It's not there, because Ephesus kept moving around because the harbor kept silting up. The river was rather fairly shallow and ran slowly in the area of Ephesus with a good bit of water, but it kept silting. So it kind of moved things with different kings over time. And the area where the Temple of Artemis was built, it's kind of outside the city. By the time ruins that archaeologists were working with came upon. At one time, it was considered to be the largest temple in the world, the Temple of Artemis in Ephesus. So these were serious matters in these places. And in a couple of the letters, two of them, I think it speaks of a synagogue of Satan. These were two places where emperor worship was particularly well known. They're called synagogues of Satan. Also, in one place, it speaks of those who claim to be Jews but are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. It's combining the fact that there was still a sizable Jewish population that wasn't Christian, that in some degree, at least politically, was a kind of persecution against the Christians and were aligned with those who were involved in emperor worship in that city. Just because you were Jewish didn't mean you're a good synagogue boy, you know, that type of thing. But in fact, the Jews had done a pretty good job of becoming fairly well integrated, apparently all over Asia Minor, because that was where they first went. When they left Judea and went north, they would go through the Levant up into the Anatolian Peninsula, head west towards Greece and Rome, and they'd be scattered all through there. In particular, much of the trading skills that were developed in Israel and Judea would be valuable to them over there. So all of those things are in play. And that's the matrix, that's the overarching set of conditions in which this vision is given to John. Now, other aspects of Jesus, besides the natural ones that I talked about earlier, he was the faithful witness, and that's repeated. He calls himself in Revelation 1, faithful witness. He repeats that in the introduction the letter of Philadelphia, and the letter to the Laodiceans. The firstborn from the dead. He repeats that in the Smyrna letter. It turns out that for nearly 300 years, Smyrna almost didn't exist. It was destroyed one time, and it almost didn't come back. And about 300 years later, somebody put some effort into getting Smyrna back on its feet, and it had become fairly prosperous again. It was dead and had come back to life. You see what's happening. What I'm trying to show you is that these plays that are going on here have to do with the communication of the things of the Lord. He's called the ruler of the kings of the earth. He was wearing a robe with a golden sash. These two are not mentioned in the letters. He has the keys of death and Hades, if you remember in Revelation 1. In the letter to the Philadelphians, he speaks of having the key of David. There's a contrast, but it's a key. See? All right. He's made us a kingdom. That relates to the song in Revelation 5, 12, where we were called together from all kinds of people, black, white, purple, orange, speaking with Chinese accents, being born in Sumatra and so forth and so on, all being brought together into a single kingdom made up of priests to our God. But that's not in these letters. Seven golden lampstands in Ephesus, in the letter to Ephesus, and the letter to Sardis. Sardis is the fifth one. Seven stars, Ephesus and Sardis again. He's speaking of the fact that he's walking among seven lampstands and has seven stars. I'm using my left hand. In his right hand, seven stars being the angels of the churches and the lampstands being the churches themselves. Repeated at Ephesus, the first church, and Sardis, the fifth, one of the most wealthy. And he's also calls himself the first and last, the protos and eschatos in the letter to Smyrna. By the way, I was taught, and you might have been, that Alpha and Omega, beginning and end, and first and last are synonymous. They're not. Okay? Jesus is not called Alpha and Omega. He's not called beginning and end. He's only called the first and last, and the other references are to God, and God's not called the first and last. He's only called Alpha and Omega and beginning and end. There's a distinction that gets lost because there's so much repetition of the terminology and people haven't paid close attention. And I might be paying too close attention, but right now I'd rather be paying too close than not enough in times like these. Thank you. Okay, so I told you the names of all those churches in the cities that they're near in Turkey. The Turkish government, when Judy and I were there 15 years ago now, was very much encouraging religious tourism, particularly by Americans in that part of the world. And so they treated us really well on the journey that we had up to Ephesus. And after we left Ephesus, we went down to another place, and I don't think it's mentioned in scripture, but I knew about it already anyway, called Didymus, because Didymus is a really big intact temple from the Greek period that was a temple made to two gods simultaneously. So there's gods, there's pagan worship with sexual, a lot of sexual license involved in it. Excessively so. The Greeks had been doing that for hundreds of years before. But in much earlier Greek times, the coming of spring was a major time of festival. And in that major time of festival, without regards to whom was whom's spousal partner, people paired off in the evenings and went out into the fields to join together in making the fields fertile. This was part of Greek culture. And it wasn't exactly part of Roman culture, but it wasn't something the Romans didn't think was pretty cool, probably. There was just this excessive influence of sexuality. And so we see, particularly with a lot of these cults that are in these cities, I think it's Pergamon, that was particularly well known for having a lot of cults. There was a lot of occultic stuff going on, with a particular emphasis on sexual excess. Three of the cities, Smyrna, Pergamum, and one of the others, I'm not sure which one the other one is that mentioned either, Jezebel, the practice of Balaam, the fellow in back in Deuteronomy, back in Numbers, I guess, who wouldn't curse the Israelites, but then told the Amorites how to beat them by getting Israelite men interested in Amorite women at a festival. And Phinehas, a grandson of Aaron, if you remember, stuck a spear plumb through an Amorite woman and an Israelite man as a result of the lewd activities in the camp. Well, this was not uncommon in these places. And in three of the letters, it's mentioned that it had been brought into the church, and that was not acceptable. Once it talks about Jezebel, twice about the Nicolaitans, and once it speaks of the practice, the teachings of Balaam, but they're all basically the same. Three different settings. In fact, I can't find really good definitive information that I trust yet about the Nicolaitans, but apparently there was a fellow running around saying, hey, you know, what these guys and gals are doing with respect to their festivals and stuff is really okay. And we're really free in Christ. So they brought that teaching, that pattern of thought into the congregations in several of these churches, probably in all of them to some extent, but in three of them, it was very much hurting the church itself, not just the city, not just the culture of the city, but the churches themselves were being very negatively impacted by all this stuff. And the Lord had stern warnings about that, very stern warnings. Like in one place, it said, Jezebel's had a little time now. She can repent, and she's not doing it. And so she's just about to suffer big time. This is not trivial in the mind of the Lord. In modern, let's face it, in modern Christian culture, if you want to call it that, there's a whole lot of adulterous behavior that goes on. It's very, very unfortunate that it's that way. The Lord does not like it. Adultery is a whole lot like witchcraft in the mind of the Lord. So this was a big deal. And he spoke to it in three of the letters to the cities. Okay, so we should be warned. In Acts 15, there's a rather lengthy description of a council that was held in Jerusalem. We believe it was the first of the councils held by church fathers. You know, the Council of Nicaea gets a lot of attention in 325, but in Acts 15, we don't know the year exactly. Paul and some of the fellows in Asia Minor went to Jerusalem to discuss the practices of some of the Jewish Christians there who are saying to the Gentile Christians who are beginning to come into the church. Remember, Paul's pattern was he goes to the synagogue, he teaches for a while, he finds out who will come with him in this new faith, and then he leaves the synagogue typically and begins to teach the Gentiles, and he forms a church, begins a church out of the Jews and the Gentiles in that city. And this conflict began to emerge between them, in which the Jewish Christians were saying, no, if they're going to be Christians, they need to be circumcised. The men need to be circumcised. And that aggravated Paul a whole lot, apparently. So he went to, took some fellows from both sides of the question, went to Jerusalem and asked for a council from the senior elders. And James apparently was sort of a presiding officer, James of the James, John, and Peter group, was apparently the presiding officer. And arguments were made back and forth. You remember the story, right? And at the end of it, James said, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're not going to cause these Gentile Christians to be circumcised. We are going to impose on them only four things. We're not there to refrain from adultery. They're to refrain from eating meat sacrificed to idols. They're to refrain to eat meat with the blood still in it. And I forget what the fourth one was now. I've already forgotten. Anyway, those four things. And two of them were what the Jezebel group and the Balaam group and the Nicolaitan group were teaching should be done in the churches in Asia Minor or in the province of Asia. And the Lord is addressing very specifically, he ain't happy about that, to John. Apparently, when Paul went back with these fellows back into Asia Minor anyway, and took back the ruling of the church in the Jerusalem Council, it still didn't fix the problem because apparently many of the Gentile Christians still wanted to be involved in that stuff. And it was splitting these really are about churches that are being split by these things, by these heresies. All seven of these churches are in a condition of being split by the presence of some heresy or multiple heresies in some cases. So that's a part of the setting also. Now, what that brings us down to, and I haven't mentioned all the possible things I could, because there's something, one or two or three things in all of the letters having to do with the attributes of Jesus, having to do with something particular about these heresies that were floating around, having to do with something particular about the cities. It's a matrix of all of those things, and everybody understood them. Everybody in this part of the world understood those things. It was very, very, very interconnected places and peoples. The churches were becoming Gentile, by which I mean really moving into a period of Gentile majorities. The Jewish beginners, the first people to come in, were normally Jewish, and they probably didn't increase in number for very long, and then the Gentiles began to come in and did increase in number over time till we got what we got today, right? I mean, you can't find people that know their ancestors were Jewish in the beginning in your churches anywhere today. But we do a lot of stuff about substitution theology and weird things like that. It's a waste of time, but there's not much real evidence. I don't want to trace my family lineage very far back. I don't think I would like what I find. So I'm going to leave all of that to somebody else. Anyway, so that's the situation. And as the churches became more Gentile, they became more like the cities in which the churches existed. See? And this is now the Lord is saying, let's address this. But he's addressing it in a way that's very specific to each of them on the one hand, and yet generalizable to us all. The whole body of Christ at any point in time in the Christian history can find itself in that matrix of those seven churches. They're not seven types. They were originally seven distinct geographic churches and geographic locations. And in those days, Paul did it. He talked about the church in such and such a place. There was only the one Christian group. There was the church in Corinth, the church in wherever it is, you pick it, the church there in Ephesus, et cetera, et cetera. So they're referred to by the city names, and that's the sort of the platform upon which this whole thing is done. So as you read the different letters, understand that the same basic phenomenon is in question. Where are they going? They seem to all be drifting. Now, two of them, by the way, Smyrna and Philadelphia, Numbers 2 and 6, the Lord doesn't actually fuss at them. He doesn't say, I have this against you. The other five, he does. But in those two, he doesn't fuss at them per se. He just says, get it together, boys and girls, before you get in trouble. You're losing it. You ain't lost it yet, but you're losing it. Now, hear me. These are the conditions inside the seven churches. These aren't the conditions of the cities in which the seven churches existed per se, although the cities were looking like the churches now, or starting to. And he was worried, not worried, the Lord knows what he's doing, but you could say he would be worried about the fact that the whole thing is going to drift off into the desert and die and leave its bones there. In fact, I had a man who was challenging me one time about all this stuff, and I said, okay, do you not believe that God can abandon a church? Oh, no, God would never abandon a church. And I said, then why does he say in one of the letters, if you don't tighten up, I'm going to take your lampstand, which is the symbol of the church itself. The lampstand is the symbol of the church in the city. If God took the lampstand out of that city, and I forget which one it was, but if he took it, there would no longer be recognizably a church in the kingdom of God in that city. And much time might pass before it happened again. Now, it turns out that all seven of those places eventually lost their lampstands. There are no churches there now. Okay, so these are serious issues. We're looking at them at the back end of history. We're saying, well, that was them. Well, yeah, sort of. But we might need to pay attention in the body of Christ today to how much of it is us also. I mean, he took a cross section, yes, in a particular geographical area, yes, but you could have found the same cross section in many parts of the Roman Empire in that day. And if you look down through history, then since then, you can still see it. The particulars might differ from place to place. But only the particulars, the phenomenology would remain the same. No longer a Jewish presence, yes. But generally speaking, the phenomenology would remain the same today. We're not exempt from the message that's being given here. We're not exempt from statements like, let's just pick one. Repent and do the things you did at first. Don't be afraid of what you're about to suffer. Go ahead and put up with it. And so there's several others similar to that scattered about in the different letters. When John's the message that John passed on to them included an admonishment of some sort. But even with Smyrna and Philadelphia, as I said, numbers 2 and 6, even though the Lord didn't fuss per se about what had happened to them, he was concerned that they were dying. They had lost whatever it was they had originally in those places. And he didn't address it in terms of Jew and Gentile. He addressed it in terms of the church and the condition it was in that place, in the time in which that message was delivered to them. Now let's get on to the good news and we'll close this down. See, it has this other purpose. It has this purpose of describing for us a category of Christian called victor. The victors were given a different promise in each of the seven letters. But I think we can accumulate all of that together. So let's accumulate the seven or all the promises to the victors in the seven letters. And the victors, in every case, are a category of those who decided to get it right. Not all of those who were members of the church in whatever city, Thyatira, but those who decided to follow the Lord's counsel and his admonition and get it right. To them would come these things. And I'm going to go through the list in a moment. Now, by a strong implication, the rest of the churches in those places would not receive the benefits that were going to accrue to the victors. It wouldn't matter to the victors that they were going to receive some benefit of being a victor if, in fact, the non-victors got the same benefits. One of the schools that, in fact, the first school Rachel went to in first grade, Rusk, yeah, that this particular school, and Rachel didn't enjoy it going every day or anything like that. It's quite an amusing story. We're not going there. But that school, years later, before we moved away from that area, they, PTA or somebody, had a bumper sticker printed up, and it said, all kids are honored at this particular elementary school, which means nobody's kid is honored at this particular elementary school. Those are exactly equivalent statements. If everybody's honored, then nobody's honored by definition. Because to honor someone is to make note of the fact that they're not part of everything else. The victors were not part of the church that chose not to be victorious, either to compromise further with the schemes of Jezebel or to just be passive and lukewarm in their response to the gospel of the kingdom. Is that making sense? So there's a purpose in speaking to the victors and sharing with them a message that was not pertinent to the non-victors in the churches. And apparently, eventually, due to historical circumstance, the victors were all gone and there wasn't anything left but the other. One of the cities I told you a minute ago was named, was near a place called Seljuk. Which one is it? Ephesus is near Seljuk. Seljuk is actually the name of the Turkish tribe that formed the first Turkish caliphate in that part of the world. There weren't any Christians left in that area when the Seljuks took over. Just not. In fact, the first and maybe the third or maybe the second, at least the first of the Great Crusades undertaken by Europeans was to kick the Seljuk Turks out of power. That particular group out of power. And see that Ephesus is pretty near Seljuk. It doesn't seem to make any sense to me to say that it wasn't referring to the Seljuk Turks since it had their name and it's a Turkish city, you know, that type of thing. Okay, so here they are. The Ephesians, he said, the victors who are not the non-victors have the right to eat from the tree of life. They will have, if they remain victorious, which is a matter of perseverance, the right to eat from the tree of life. Now, the tree of life hasn't appeared in Scripture since Genesis at this point, Genesis 3. Tree of life's not mentioned again once God sealed it off from access. And then it goes on to say the tree of life in God's paradise, indicating that there is some identity between the Garden of Eden and where these Ephesian victors have access to the tree of life. I don't want to get far into that because that'll get theologically extremely quickly. It's not our purpose. The second church, Smyrna, by the way, Smyrna, is that port is a particularly valuable port. It had an outer port and then a protected area and then an inner port. Great, great port city. And Smyrna apparently is derived from the name of the Greek word for myrrh, the spice called myrrh, because apparently it was a place you could go and acquire myrrh from the Europeans, could go and get it in Smyrna. Ephesus, by the way, was named after one of the early Hittite cities. Anyway, in Smyrna, those who were victors were given life again. Remember Smyrna, I said earlier, was kind of non-existent for much of 250 years, and then it was resurrected and made into a great port city, quite wealthy. To those folks, life and immunity to the second death was given, related to the characteristics of the city itself. To Pergamum was given some hidden manna. The victors in Pergamum would receive hidden manna. Hidden manna seems theologically to mean stuff that's in Scripture that we mostly don't see very well. That the victors in Pergamum then, even though they're only typological, would have access to revelation. And they would be given a white stone that would have their individual new names on it. And if they didn't have to tell anybody else what their new name was, that's their business. They didn't have to if they didn't want to. But they got a new name from the Lord. Now, if he showed up to give you a new name, would you think that'd be cool? Give you a white stone, and on the bottom of it, it says, it's no longer Martha, now it's Marta. No, wait. You can see how that might be wonderful if the Lord said, Katrina, your name's really not Katrina. Well, Lord, what is it? Your name's really Bob. No, that wouldn't work. But you can see that the Lord giving you a name would be different than your mama giving you one. I don't have any disrespect for my mama in that regard. Okay. But you can see how him giving you a name might have much more meaning in it than in the other name. So the victors will get one of those. Did the victors in Thyatira, this group to me is absolutely fascinating. I think I would like to go stand in the ruins of Thyatira just to soak in what this says. They will be given authority over the nations, and they will rule them with iron scepters and dash them like pottery. Let me tell you, my belief is that this actually says that the victors over the Thyatiran kind of a problem will get iron scepters, which strongly imply weaponry, something that can be used to punish. By the way, the scepter was always partially meant to be used for punishment. In fact, if you remember the story of Esther, the way the woman survived would be if the king held out his scepter to her. If he didn't, it's bad news for Esther to show up there. I mean, that was having your life hanging on a string when Esther went to see the king, knowing that if he didn't hold out his scepter to her, she was in trouble. Okay. The scepter is an extremely important statement about the power of the king, the power of the ruler. And he's going to give iron scepters, not scepters made out of flexible plastic, which is all he should entrust us with, but iron scepters capable of smashing the nations, because we'll rule with him over the nations. And he'll also give them the morning star. And I do not yet, nor have I ever heard something that satisfies me as to what the morning star is here. I know there's interpretations of it, but I know that's a plural. And several have good foundations. I'm not settled on it yet. That's all. That's all I'm saying about that. But it is also something pretty special. The church in Sardis, the place probably where the matter of robbing the people blind with coinage started out and became a ridiculously rich place, the place where they built a royal road all the way from the Persian capital to Sardis for the king's traffic, a royal road, that's like selling seashells on the seashore, a royal road was the king's road. The king paid for it for a reason. It had to do with trade that had to do with the king, his purposes. And if you could get to the royal road, a couple of things would happen. Usually it was a pretty smooth road. And usually it would be well protected from bandits. And usually if you held up a caravan on the royal road, they would actually find you. And then usually other people would find your parts scattered about the countryside. This was serious stuff, these royal roads. So Sardis was in a pretty good place. Here's what they got: white raiment. Well, who cares about that? Well, they were famous for black wool. The contrast? You see the contrast? They were famous as being purveyors of black wool. And he was going to dress the victors in white raiment, like the folks in Revelation 7 and in 19 in particular. And he would see to it that their names were never blotted out of the book of life. If you were a victor in Sardis, your name was recorded in the book of life indelibly. I think that's probably true for us all, but nonetheless, that was part of the promise. And furthermore, he would acknowledge them before God and his angels. That means in some manner, probably involving an introduction, at some point, he would say, here is one of these victors of this particular Sardisian kind. And there might well be a day when there's an, not that there are days and the time to come. Well, yes, there are too. There would be a point in time in which that aspect of victory would result in a special appearance before the Father himself in the future. Pretty big deal. And there's still angels around in this. And so it's obviously during the eras of the epochs of creation. To the Philadelphian victors, he said he would make them pillars in the temple of God. Now, that sounds pretty cool. And it is. I wouldn't mind being considered a pillar in the temple of God. I'm not sure that I want people to think of me entirely as being a piece of stone or anything like that. Although I used to have a nickname with some people of stone face. There was some people that actually called me that. They didn't call me that. They called me that when they were talking to other people. Yeah, it was a, not a big group. But the pillar thing is kind of interesting because Philadelphia is one of two places that was particularly prone to earthquakes. And the purpose of a pillar is to hold something up. And if you're in an earthquake-prone place, an earthquake-prone area, you use more pillars, bigger pillars. It's just simply, again, an instance of making something very relevant to the Philadelphians out of their situation. But to the one who is a victor, their name, they would become pillars in the temple of God. And this obviously ultimately is the temple of God in heaven, because there is no temple in the New Jerusalem, because God and Jesus are the temple in the New Jerusalem. Yes. So if this is in the New Jerusalem, then somehow or another these people are somehow components in the temple that is God and the Lamb. That's pretty serious stuff. Again, that's Philadelphia. And in addition to being pillars, he would write on them God's name, some name of the New Jerusalem, and his own new name. He has, I believe, already a new name. We just don't know what it is. Is that weird for you? If you're a victor, you already have a new name. You haven't been shown what it is yet, but that's part of the promise. You, if you are a victor, and I don't know whether you are or not, I hope you are, every one of you. If you are, you will have a new name, and that new name is already known. That white stone has already been written on, and your name is already on it indelibly, and he'll hand it to you, and he won't make a mistake. If Katrina's new name is Bob, she's going to get the stone that says Bob. He's not going to make mistakes. Okay, so these names are going to be on there, and they're going to be written on us, on the victors, in the Philadelphian aspect of our victor personality, the victor person that we will be. I've already hinted at, and I'm going to get to it. The Laodicea, the last one, he said to the Laodicean victors, they will have the right to sit on the throne with him, just as he earned the right to sit on the throne with his Father. It will be the same thing. We will sit with him in his throne in the same sense of the magnificence of who he is, in the same sense that he sits on the throne with his Father. That actually is a big deal. Ain't a little bitty thing. The victors will be seated with him on his throne in the same sense, it specifies it, that he is sitting on the throne with his Father. Now, these thrones weren't little bitty chairs like this green thing I'm sitting in. Throne might be quite a large thing, in case you're all worried about being too close to each other. It's going to be all right. All of this, all of these, whatever it is, 11 or 12 things, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 things are bequeathals is the best word I've come up with, to the category of believer called victor, who is, in my opinion, always a victor, is not involved or trapped in any of the controversial compromises that show up in any of the seven churches. We will overcome, the victors will overcome whatever it is that leads men and women into being compromised in the context of some particular flavor, some particular facet of the church. We are but one kingdom. These churches were all over in these different cities, but it was all the same kingdom. And as I said two or three times already earlier, these guys all knew each other. They all saw all seven of the letters. The church where it specified that that woman Jezebel was there, which I think is Thyatira. Everybody knew what that was about in all seven of the churches. Wasn't like it was a big surprise to anybody. It was just a matter of it being pointed out. Here is what it is. Here's why you are in danger of not being a victor. Yeah. These things. And he made them very relevant to the particular institution or the particular settings that he was talking to. They were made very relevant. They are relevant to us in the sense that he couldn't list a few million places in the letter. It would have gone on way too long. We'd get bored with it. He picked the seven that were the seven chief cities in the Roman province of Asia in that day and time and said, you know, these are it. These guys are the guys that everybody else pays attention to. They are the capitals. And all of the other little towns and villages bring their trade and their taxes and every other kind of due they may have into one of these places. And these places receive all the royal attention, the imperial attention, I should say, in the case of Rome. They're the ones that get the imperial. So when an order goes out from Rome, it goes to Ephesus, and the leaders in Ephesus have to make sure that everybody in a pretty good sized area hears about it. That's a responsibility they have. And bring all the taxes into Ephesus and ship them to Rome and so forth and so forth and so forth. These were the places. So that's why he picked them. He didn't pick them because they had these problems. He picked them and they had these problems. And he just used that fact to point out to us a bunch of general information about what he's expecting things to look like in the end of time, in the time shortly to come.